If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. 2 centuries ago, in 1820, a group of political radicals launched a revolutionary plan to murder the cabinet in what became known as the Cato Street Conspiracy. This bungled plot is the subject of today's episode. Our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, spoke to the author and historian Stephen Bates, who wrote a feature on Cato Street for the March issue of BBC History Magazine, to find out more about how the conspiracy unfolded.
Stephen, 200 years ago, in February 1820, Britain was rocked by the Cato Street Conspiracy, which is a botched attempt to butcher the entire cabinet. I was wondering if you could start just describing the conspiracy in a bit greater detail.
Yes, the Cato Street Conspiracy was a botched assassination attempt by a group of would-be revolutionaries in London to kill the entire British cabinet when they sat at dinner. It was a conspiracy that really never happened, because the plotters, although they were deadly serious, didn't know that they were being set up by the government itself, and they were getting all ready to go out on their assassination spree when they were interrupted by Bow Street runners, the policemen of the day, and most of them were arrested in a great big scuffle in a stable in Cato Street, which is just off the Edgware Road. It's a little side street cul-de-sac, and some of them escaped, most of them didn't, and were rounded up, and the ringleaders were subsequently put on trial and would be executed a few months later in a particularly brutal fashion. But it was something that caused the government great panic and confusion and fear. And it was, for a very brief moment in time, something of deadly seriousness to the British state.
Sure. And can you tell us a little bit more about the lead conspirators? I mean, I understand the man who led the conspiracy was a man called Arthur Thistlewood. I mean, what was his background and what inspired his radicalism?
Yes, Arthur Thistlewood, and it's a very British sort of name. It doesn't sound much like Vladimir Lenin or any of the other great revolutionaries of history. He was an illegitimate son of a Lincolnshire farmer who'd had a reasonable start in life, but he'd failed in most of the schemes he'd adopted to make money. He'd been briefly an ensign in the local militia up in Yorkshire, and he'd failed as a farmer during the course of the Napoleonic War, and he drifted into London, where he became radicalised. This sounds a bit like modern Muslim radicals and extremists. He became radicalised listening and reading the revolutionary doctrines of a man called Thomas Spence, who was a bookseller in London and a pamphleteer, who believed that the only way that society could be made more equitable and liberty established was for all the land in the country to be held in common, to be owned by the parish in each case and let out to the local inhabitants and rebid for every year. It was a land redistribution scheme, which, of course, was utterly opposed by any landowners. And, of course, Parliament was made up entirely of landowners, as, of course, was the government. So they were never going to be interested or enthusiastic for the Spencean doctrines. And indeed, Spencer was locked up for sedition several times, and he had died in 1814, though his ideas lived on.
And so Thistlewood basically took on his ideas then. And who did he gather around him? What do we know about the other lead conspirators?
Well, Thistlewood had been involved in the radical movements around various political movements in London during the post-Napoleonic War period after Waterloo. And the people who joined him in the stable block in Cato Street were men who similarly had been disappointed in life, had been economic failures whose businesses and trades had collapsed after the Napoleonic Wars. One was a butcher, another was a bootmaker, a third was a tradesman of boots and shoes, and one was a cabinet maker. They'd all lost out economically in the post-war depression, and they were practically starving, most of them. They didn't have any money, and they were easily seduced by the idea that a new government would produce prosperity and, more importantly, food for all. One of the plotters in an earlier uprising a couple of years before was told that there would be a provisional government set up, which he took to mean a government that would provide provisions for everyone.
Right, okay. So would it be safe to say this wasn't a very well-organised conspiracy? I mean, did it ever stand any realistic chance of succeeding?
No, it wouldn't have ever succeeded, not least because the government had infiltrated all the radical movements that sprang up in this period. They sent spies, paid informers into the movements, and some of them not only reported back on what radicals were saying, but also helped to foster some of the plans and plots that were current at that time. They even incited uprisings. So far from being just informers, they were proactive participants. And that was the case in Cato Street as well, because Thistlewood's deputy was a man called George Edwards. And Thistlewood obviously trusted him implicitly. And unfortunately, Edwards was the spy in the middle of the plot.
So how did the two meet? Do we know?
I think they probably met. It's not entirely clear, but I think they probably met through the radical networks and circles of groups and plotters around and about the capital. Most people campaigning for political change after the Napoleonic War were actually peaceful demonstrators, although they terrified the government and those in authority, because they naturally thought, ministers thought, that beginning reform, as the Duke of Wellington said, was equivalent to beginning revolution. They thought that however moderate people's political demands were for representation in Parliament, that would only lead to the French Revolution style, where everyone would in authority would have their heads cut off. And
so do they see kind of the thin end of the wedge then?
They saw it as very much the thin end of the wedge.
Yeah. Okay, so did the government at the time use informers? Was that a common tactic of theirs, to plant informers in sort of potential radical cells?
Yes, it was, because the government, of course, in those days didn't have a police force. The nearest they had was the Bow Street Runners, who were a professional force, but didn't cover the entire country and were fairly haphazard and amateurish in many respects. So the government had relatively few levers to keep track on potential subversives and revolutionaries. And they used spies and informers, very often men who were down on their luck, who offered themselves to the Home Secretary, Viscount Sidmouth, in return for money. And they were often as disreputable as the plotters themselves. They came from the same milieu. They were motivated by money to get out of the poverty trap. And frankly, the government didn't assess them particularly closely or monitor their activities as closely as they might have done. They were just happy to be told what was going on. And George Edwards was the man in this particular instance who conceived of the plot and certainly inspired it.
So how exactly did he do that? What tactics did George Edwards employ to sort of provoke the plot, as it were?
Well, he told Thistlewood that there was a plan for the whole cabinet to meet at dinner at the house of Lord Harrowby, who was the president of the council. And that house was in Grosvenor Square, which, of course, is not very far away from the Edgware Road and Cato Street.
Yeah.
And he claimed that there was an advertisement in one of the London newspapers at the time saying that the cabinet were all going to have dinner together. And Thistlewood immediately thought this would be a great opportunity with them all together to break into the house and assassinate them, cut off their heads, stick them on poles on London Bridge, and the working class would rise up and acclaim their new provisional government.
And so they gathered in this, am I right in saying this hayloft, is that right?
Yeah, it was the loft above a rather dilapidated stables.
Yeah, and that was where the Bow Street runners burst in upon them, is that correct?
Yes, I mean, the Bow Street runners were keeping the place under surveillance, but were not exactly discreet about it. They were hanging around the street corner and opposite the pub at the end of the street, and the conspirators brushed past them. In fact, Thistlewood, who probably knew one or two of them at least by sight, brushed past a couple of Bow Street runners on his way up to the hayloft, said, "Oh, excuse me," as he squeezed his way past, stared at them in the face, and still went on with it. So he maybe not have been the sharpest knife in the box.
And then, am I right in saying that one of the Bow Street runners was killed in the loft?
Yes, that's right, Spencer. The access to the loft was by a single ladder up through a trapdoor, and the Bow Street runners burst in just as the plotters were arming themselves for the evening's work. There were only 20 plotters who turned up. Thistlewood had been expecting 50, which he thought was the bare minimum to carry out the plot, but most of them had got cold feet already. And he decided he'd better press on even so. And they were buckling up sabres and cutlasses and muskets and goodness knows what. And suddenly, up through the trapdoor, like the genie in a pantomime, came the Bow Street runners. You can imagine it was a dark loft lit by candlelight, which probably pretty rapidly got doused. And so it was a scuffle almost in the dark because it was nighttime. And Thistlewood seized a sword and ran through one of the first Bow Street runners to get into the loft, a man called Richard Smithers, who proclaimed, "Oh, I'm dead," and dropped to his dropped to the floor. And Thistlewood and most of the others managed to scramble out through the windows or down the steps, and tried to make good their escape. But there were more Bow Street officers outside, and most of them were rounded up. Although, as it was pitch black, no street lighting in those days, some people managed to creep away. Some were never caught.
You write in your feature for the magazine that the conspirators planned to cut off the hands of the Foreign Secretary, a man by the name of, is it Lord Castlereagh? What made him such a hate figure for the conspirators?
Castlereagh was a difficult man to like, I think. He was fairly young. He was an Ulsterman with an Ulsterman's hard accent, I suspect. And although he wasn't a very good speaker in the Commons, he took a hard line on most of the issues of the day. And he was regarded as one of those implacable Tory hard-faced men who'd done well out of the war, to coin a later phrase. He was regarded much more even than Lord Liverpool, the Prime Minister, as the hard man of the cabinet. I don't suppose you can draw direct analogies, but a sort of Dominic Cummings hard-faced figure in those days, although he was an MP, he was an elected politician, and he was the Foreign Secretary.
Right, Ken. Now, how much sympathy for the conspirators and the conspiracy would there have been among the wider British public, do you think?
I think it's very difficult to say. Certainly, members of the crowd who turned up for their subsequent execution were relatively sympathetic towards them. The economy was on the turn by this stage. It was people were beginning to get more money in their pockets and more food in their bellies. And the appetite for radical uprisings or even radical demands for political reform was just beginning to wane. And I think people were pretty intimidated. They'd seen what had happened to peaceful demonstrators in Manchester 6 months before, when the cavalry had charged a peaceful meeting and 18 people were killed in the massacre of Peterloo, as it was called. The government's repressive policies had been a pretty effective deterrent. So I suspect sympathy was fairly limited towards Mr. Thistlewood and his crew.
And did that apply to a lot of radicals as well? Am I right in saying there's a bit of an argument among the radical community, as in some promoted more peaceful measures and some promoted more sort of violent measures such as these taken by the conspirators?
Yes, there were two strands of thought about how to gain political reform at this stage in the 19th century. One, the much larger strand, was a sort of respectable, peaceable approach to political reform. Making the argument, peaceful demonstrations, petitions to the Commons, rather respectful and certainly not at all violent. But there was a smaller breakaway faction, of which Thistlewood was an eminent example, which said, no, the whole system needed shaking up and a revolution, as in France, was what was needed to change the whole political circumstances of the country.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Well, in the way, it's both the first and the last of political terrorism in this country. It was the first attempt to destroy the cabinet by assassination, and it was the first of a new sort of terrorism in many respects.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And how long a shadow did the French Revolution cast over these events? I mean, I imagine that was a source of real fear for the government.
Oh, it certainly was. And it was only at this stage 30 years in the past. So it was well within living memory. And in fact, both Lord Liverpool and Lord Castlereagh, the two leading members of the government, had been students at Cambridge in the 1780s and early 1790s. And both of them had gone over to France to witness the events there. Indeed, Castlereagh had started off fairly sympathetic, as a lot of young, slightly more radical people were in the 1780s, before the French Revolution turned violent and people started having their heads cut off. That certainly turned Castlereagh against radicalism and out of all sympathy with the French Revolution. But what had happened in France, the turmoil and the massacres and the executions and the bloodletting, was certainly a terrible warning as far as the British ruling class, the aristocracy, was concerned.
Okay, now what about the Napoleonic Wars? I mean, did they help make conditions fertile for an attempted revolution at this time?
Well, the Napoleonic Wars were over after 1815 and the Battle of Waterloo, but that was succeeded by a number of economic circumstances which had a very destabilising effect on the country, which had been at war for the previous 25 years. First of all, there were a lot of disbanded soldiers who were coming home looking for work. The economy was somewhat in decline because a lot of the wartime economy was wound down at that stage. And on top of all that, with the loss of demand for employment from employers, with a reduction in wages following the end of the war, and with the coincidence of a series of very bad summers and very bleak harvests, which put up the price of food. So you had a sort of vice-like grip of lower wages and higher prices. And that was what stirred a lot of the discontent. The bad weather that was associated with the summers after 1815, 1816, 1817, 1818 and 1819 were actually caused, although they didn't know it at the time, by an enormous eruption in the Indonesian islands of a volcano called Mount Tambora, which is probably the biggest eruption of a volcano, certainly in recorded history. Right. And that spread a black cloud across the Northern Hemisphere and caused what was known as the summer without sunshine. Certainly in 1816, 1817, very bad harvests, very disruptive weather, snow in June in England, for instance, and mass starvation was the result of all that. So there was a lot of reason for discontent, not all of it directly connected with the French, the Napoleonic Wars, but certainly arising as a consequence of them.
Sure. Now, as you've already hinted at, the punishments meted out to the conspirators, was truly gruesome. I think I'm right in saying that five were hanged outside Newgate Prison before their heads were hacked off with a butcher's knife. Now, why was the government determined to make such a spectacle of their deaths? And what was the public reaction to that?
The government was certainly concerned to make an example of the plotters, to actually terrify and overawe anyone who might think that this was an acceptable form of protest. And it was a relic of the Middle Ages hang, drawing and quartering that men should be beheaded. Actually, the punishment was that they should be hanged and cut down from the noose while they were still alive and then having their heads cut off. But George IV was marginally more civilized, I suppose you could say, right, than that, and allowed that the convicted men should be hanged until death, and then their heads would be cut off. And this, even 200 years ago, you can imagine the revulsion that there was to this. There was quite a backlash against it, and it was never tried again.
What would you say was the immediate fallout from the plot? Was it followed by a government crackdown more generally?
Yes, it was. The government was already cracking down on dissent, limiting rights of association, and a number of repressive acts designed specifically to prevent assemblies and associations which might lead to men conspiring to, as they thought, overthrow the government or inspire a revolution. Actually, it cracked down on people who perfectly legitimately were arguing for political change and even constitutional change by constitutional means.
And would I be right in saying that that crackdown worked? I mean, it strikes me that there weren't many more Cato Street conspiracies over the following decades. Is that a direct result of the government's actions, do you think?
Well, there were, but what happened was that from 1820 onwards, once the effects of Mount Tambora had waned, harvests improved, prices went down, employment started to pick up, and so there was less immediate pressure for political and constitutional change for a few years. Everything was pretty cyclical, and within 10 years or so, there would be agricultural unrest in the country, the swing riots and disturbances, a revolt by the peasantry, the countryside peasantry across southern England, against food prices and poor wages and working conditions. And then there would be agitation, of course, for political reform. The Great Reform Act came in 1832, and that would be succeeded by the Chartist movement in the 1830s and 40s, which was, by and large, a peaceful movement calling for political representation, political change. And, of course, that then was defeated essentially in after 1848. The movement was on the wane and dispersed again as economic conditions improved in the 1850s. So there was a cyclical response to political reform. Of course, political reform did come eventually and slowly through a number of political reforms during the 19th century. There's the Reform Act of 1832. The franchise was widened again in 1867 and again in the 1880s, and then after the First World War, when women finally got the vote. And these were largely responses to political pressure from outside, but they were peaceful movements for political change, although certainly the Chartists caused the government quite a lot of worry.
Do we get any indication from any of the sources of what impact the plot had on its intended targets, you know, the likes of Lord Castlereagh? I mean, did they have to beef up their own personal security?
Well, there are a number of personal letters and diaries, including by Princess Lieven, who was the wife of the Russian ambassador, who found herself at dinner with Lord Castlereagh soon after the Cato Street conspiracy. And she recorded that he showed her the pistols he'd started carrying with him, just in case he got attacked again. She found that rather alarming. Princess Lieven actually attended the execution of the Cato Street conspirators and was repulsed by it. She thought it was unnecessarily cruel to conduct the executions in that way.
And how much of a cause célèbre was the Cato Street conspiracy? I mean, did it really grab the nation's attention?
Well, I guess it grabbed the political nation's attention. Of course, the press was not as not as widely read or as accessible in those days as it would later become in the century. But yes, certainly the political classes were very well aware of what had happened. They were aware of a series of semi-violent uprisings, most of them fairly minor, but potentially very violent. So people did know about it. There were national newspapers like The Times, and soon there would be the Manchester Guardian and other regional papers, which were reporting these events. But certainly there was no sort of follow-up mass uprising. One of the things Thistlewood told his followers was that there was an uprising in Glasgow. Now, he didn't have any contact with that, but he'd been told that people were rising up in Glasgow. In fact, the Glasgow uprising really didn't happen. They scarcely got out of the pub. It was very difficult to coordinate those sorts of actions together. And at that stage, there wasn't the united national action which really would have concerned the authorities.
So what for you makes a Cato Street conspiracy such a significant event in British history?
Well, in the way, it's both the first and the last of political terrorism in this country. It was the first attempt to destroy the cabinet by assassination. And it was the first of a new sort of terrorism in many respects. Terrorism that we're relatively used to these days, of violent direct action. And of course, it was a complete failure in its day. But sufficiently alarming and terrifying to the authorities to make repression, certainly temporarily, much stronger. And that would probably lead in the 1820s to the attempt to set up a metropolitan police force, the Bobbies of Robert Peel fame. As a long-term thing, Britain really didn't have a revolutionary movement until arguably after the First World War. And it certainly didn't have a terrorist movement probably until the IRA in the 1980s. And of course, the IRA very nearly succeeded in assassinating the cabinet at the Brighton bomb at the Tory party conference in 1984. So the IRA, 160 odd years later, got rather further than Arthur Thistlewood ever managed.
So in some ways, it was very much a modern plot then.
Well, in the nihilistic way that it was carried out and intended, yes, it was. It certainly didn't have a particularly coherent political philosophy behind it, except an anarchistic one in many ways, although I doubt that Thistlewood would have recognised it as such.
That was Stephen Bates. You can read his feature on the Cato Street conspiracy in the March issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now. And it also includes articles on Henry V, the Dark Ages, cat burglars and the Glencoe massacre. You can also read more about the Cato Street plot at our website at historyextra.com/Cato Street Conspiracy. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in next on Monday when Elmer Brenner will be discussing medieval medicine.